Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host today, Monica Hadley, and with us is Olivia Campbell. Now, Olivia is the New York Times bestselling author of Women in White Coats and a journalist and essayist specializing in women in science, women's health, motherhood, and the intersection of science and culture. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, National Geographic, New York Magazine, and everything else that is that we all want to read. So, and the book that we're talking about today is Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Olivia.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is your scientific background?
None. I'm a journalist. I love coming to these topics with a really, an open mind and no preconceived notions. I feel like I can be a really great stand-in for an average reader to help translate. I have a master's degree in science journalism. So, there is.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
there is that. I'm a writer. I don't have technically a science degree or anything. I'm not, I won the science fair in sixth grade, and I think that's when I peaked. But
do you remember what your project was?
I do. It was feeding different foods to pond scum things in different jars. Why I remember it is because I left it in our closet at home for too long, and it started to really stink.
Oh, I bet. I don't think we did science fair when I was a kid. I don't remember doing that. But I did with my kids, so I remember helping them with their projects. But I guess I'm too old. Because that was so much fun, the whole science fair thing. And it gets people interested in science. Now, the thing about these four women that you're writing about, so they became scientists in the 1920s and 30s, right? When it was almost impossible to do that. Can you just give us, what's your view of how these women how were they so dedicated to be able to get advanced degrees in science against all odds?
I think that's what draws me to all of these stories, all the books that I've written and people I'm interested in is why. There's so much against you. There's, there's people actively working against you. There's people telling you to your face, you don't belong here. People writing about you in papers saying you don't belong here. It's just incredible to me that they still persisted even amidst all this. Yes, these are the some of the first women to get physics degrees, some of the first women to be allowed to attend universities in Germany at this time. They were not welcome. I start the book with an anecdote about the mathematician, who is not a center of the book, but it's just a fantastic story because she comes a few years before my four main women. She was friends with Einstein. Einstein thought she was an absolute genius, and she was. But they kept telling her, no, you can't come teach at this university. We don't want women here. It doesn't matter that you've managed to qualify as a mathematician in this other German state where women were allowed to attend university before some other states. It doesn't matter that you're solving theorems that no one's ever been able to solve before. You're a woman. We don't want you. No, the men at this university aren't going to listen to you. So it doesn't matter.
And in some ways, we've come a long way since then. In some ways, we haven't.
it is a bit saddening. Yeah, it's always a bit upsetting to see how much farther we could be, if we really chose to.
And the thing is, when I'm reading these things, the thing that always strikes me, and it has, is that the nations and the societies and the cultures that basically ignore the talents and abilities of 50% of their population are not going to be the most successful because of that. They are missing out.
Yes, what we have lost as a society, as a culture, to sexism, to racism, to anti-Semitism, to you know, all the isms, all the ways that we look other people and look at people as different and not equal. And there's so many brilliant minds that are being overlooked and quashed because of hatred, because of intolerance. That really, it shines through in this book. And as you see, well, these four women scientists survived, but you know, all these other academics and other people didn't.
Right. And it really could have cost Germany the war in their discrimination against women and Jewish people.
It's mind-boggling how much was lost. Because they broke up all these scientific collectives that were working they were making so many discoveries so quickly during this era, especially in physics. Like, I really can't overstate how important Germany was to physics at this time. Like, because of all the people that were there who were experts, the top people in the field, that brought more and more people. So, like, it kept adding upon itself to become this incredible center of physics education, of physics advances, of research. And then the Nazis come in and break up all these collectives because they decided that Jewish scientists, Jewish thinkers are not acceptable. They're not humans. So they disperse all these amazing scientific groups. And so we lost all of that research, all of them, what could have been.
Wow. You know, you just wonder, yeah, what cures for cancer, what alternative energy sources, what computer power, you know, what was lost and maybe will be found at some point, but maybe not.
One of the couples that I talk about in the chapter about who was murdered by the Nazis, there was a husband and wife team in the medical research field who were murdered by the Nazis because they were Jewish. But one of their sons, actually both of their kids were scientists, but their son took over their research and went on to win a Nobel but you know, had they been able to do it themselves, they, you know, it probably would have been faster, it would have been bigger, who knows what it could have been, you know.
So and I found that interesting too, because the wife was unpaid basically, and probably doing the equal work.
If not,
you know, who knows? She might have even been leading it. We don't know. But
yeah, and she's raising the kids too, right?
Yeah. Wow.
That's a common theme in all of these women's lives, is that to get your foot in the door, you had to forgo a paycheck in most of these situations. I kept having arguments with my copy editor. She's like, you can't call this a job if it's unpaid. I'm like, well, I don't know what to tell you, but that's how it was for them then. Like, it was considered a job. You wouldn't have called it like a volunteer position. They considered it a job because they did a full job's work. I mean, it was basically an unpaid internship, but it was considered a job, right?
Yeah. Well, tell me about the four women and who they were and why you chose these four women to focus on.
I found these women poking around at some data sets that were compiled about all of the women academics who fled Germany, were trapped in Nazi-occupied areas, who needed to flee. It was basically looking at who was awarded funding, that had applied for funding at international organizations. It looked at if they made it out or not. It looked at where they went. It discussed, like, had so many amazing data points, what languages they spoke, whether they were married, whether they had kids, you know. It was an amazing resource. So I'm just like trawling through this huge spreadsheet with the idea of, okay, maybe I will have a book where I compare one woman who made it out and one woman who didn't make it out. So if I'm trying to find this, but then I come across these four women with H names, Hertha, Hildegard, and Hedwig, and well, three women with H names, and then Lise, of course, Lise Meitner. We add her in. But yes, these three H name women who were all atomic spectroscopists, physicists, like the fact that they were in this tiny little area of physics, I was like, okay, there's something here. And I dug a little further and found out that they knew each other. You know, all of them at one point had met each other, and not only that, but they helped each other escape Germany, help them flee the Nazis. So once one woman came out, the other women, you know, needed to come out later, and they would help them with writing applications, helping with visas, helping find them jobs, you know. And these women were in a totally new job and surrounding themselves, right? They had just moved to a totally different country, new culture, new language, and yet they're spending their money, their time, their effort to try and save these people that are left behind.
Wow. How did they know each other? I mean, like, were they all at the same university, or did they all know the same person that introduced them?
So we have Lise and Hertha work together at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in the 20s. So they were great friends there for a couple of years, and then Hertha and her mentor moved on to a different organization shortly thereafter, but they stayed, you know, they stayed friends, they stayed in touch. And then we have, let's see, I couldn't figure out how Hildegard knew Hertha and James, but I'm pretty sure they all would have met at physics, like annual meetings in Germany, right?
Right.
Hildegard and Hertha went to school together. Those two went to college together, undergrad. It was Hertha's second college. She went to like one college for a little bit, and then she transferred to another one. So she knew Hildegard there. And then Hedwig knew Einstein. She'd met with Lise before, and then Lise helps Hedwig to escape. She stays with her in Sweden after Lise has just escaped, and tries to, you know, help her acclimate, help her, you know, calm down from the sort of terror of escaping with her life. There's different points of knowing and meeting each other. And by the end, they all, you know each other, met each other, worked together at Duke. So Hertha, sort of being the first one to get out, takes it upon herself to help the other women. And also, once they've arrived in America, she invites them to come do research at her Duke University lab, because she's got this huge, great lab where the other women are at smaller colleges. A lot of them end up at women's colleges, and they don't really have the resources or the time to do the kind of research they want. So she invites them, like, during the summer to come work with her in her giant Duke lab that she's created special for this kind of research, this kind of physics. So, yes, they end up all collaborating and working together at the end.
Wow. So were there other women scientists who were sort of in that circle as well, or was it really just the four of them?
When they're in Germany, they're in different, they sort of spread out in different little circles. They don't all have the same circles all the time. Like, some of them work together for a little bit, or some of them went to school together for a little bit. I think Hedwig's Breslau University physics lab, that where she was based, I believe they were pretty much more progressive in hiring women. If you look at the photos from their annual outings, their different activities, their research photos, you'll see a lot more women there than you would at other places. There's photos of Hertha at KWI and other subsequent universities and organizations that she works at, and she's the only woman in those photos for most of the time. I think that's why she and Lise really sort of stayed great friends and kept writing this, because there wasn't really a lot of other high-level women scientists in the picture for her that she could be, you know, that would understand what they were going through.
And what was the age range of these women? How far apart were they in age? You said two of them were in college together, so they would have been close to the same, but the others were older?
I think Hedwig was, let's see, Hedwig was the first to get a PhD. Lise was definitely older. Lise was like maybe 8, 10 years, I want to say. She was at least a decade further in her career than the other ones. I think the others are probably in their 40s and 50s when this is happening, and Lise is well into her 50s.
Okay.
So yeah, they're settled in their careers. They're set. They're thinking that, oh yeah, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life at this institute with these amazing people, with my lab that I've set up exactly how I like it, and you know, everything's where it's supposed to be. And then, you know, the Nazis blow everything up.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Olivia Campbell, author of Sisters in Science: How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. So the best known of these probably is Lise, and tell, you know, but still many of us have never heard of her.
I was so angry researching this. So, this was a very emotional book. It's very, you know, it's emotionally upsetting to do any sort of Holocaust research. It's angering to do any sort of, you know, historical sexism research. It's a lot.
Yeah, no kidding. Man, the things these women had to go through.
So Lise Meitner should be as much of a household name as Einstein, Schrodinger. You know, we have so many male physicists that we can pull out of the top of our head, you know, at any point. You know, Lise worked with Einstein. She was a colleague. They were colleagues. So was Herta at the KWI. They worked with Einstein. There's photos of them hanging out together. These women were making findings that then these great men would build upon and, you know, continue to make, it would turn into this amazing theorem, this amazing idea that would change, you know, the nature of how we thought of physics forever. So, because they're sort of their a lot of their ideas are further back in the line, we're not getting noticed, right? But also, women were held back so long from going to university and then from qualifying to become a university professor. So they're holding these assistant positions for much longer than a man would in the same position, right? And so they're not getting recognition. We have Lee's establishing this research project for, you know, it's taking several years, but at the end of these 2 years, she will have discovered nuclear fission, right? That was her project. She instigated this project. She brought Otto Hahn on, and to his reluctance, he was like, oh, I'm the head of the whole organization. I don't think I'll have time for this. And, you know, maybe I won't be in it. She finally convinced him to come do this research project with her. It's, you know, it's a project that goes for several years. And they find weird things along the way, and they're trying to interpret it. And finally, at the end, right before they do their final study that brings them the information to the realization of what is actually going on, Lise is sent away. She can't stay in Germany any longer. She's lasted as long as she possibly could, and she has to escape, or she will be rounded up and taken to a camp, certainly. So she finally makes it out, a daring train escape, and she tries to continue this is the research project. She wants, she knows there's something there. She sees that they're so close to something. so she's writing letters as much as she can. A lot of what they say, you know, has to be, they have to sort of self-monitor. They can't say certain things to each other. A lot of their letters had to be passed, you know, it couldn't be posted, because mail was being opened up. So they finally do this final research study, and Otto says, I don't know how to interpret this. He's a chemist, she's a physicist. So they would do these studies where he would interpret the chemistry and she would interpret the physics. That's why it works. That's why they were so successful, because it was interdisciplinary. So he's like, I don't know how to interpret these findings. These don't make sense within the parameters of how we understand physics to work, how we understand the laws of nature, and what should be happening in this study is not happening in this reaction here. So the realization of what's really happening is Lise, is down to Lise. She's going on a walk with her nephew, who's also a physicist. It's Christmas time, it's winter, they're in Sweden. The nephew's visiting, and she realizes that, it's broken in half. That's what, it's fission. So that it's her discovery. She names it, she makes it. They put in that paper, and at the same time, Otto is drafting a different paper that sort of says the same thing, but not quite, because he didn't get to communicate with her in time. But he actually made a couple mistakes in that paper. But then he is credited with the discovery of fission because he's the one that was left at the institute. He's the one that was, officially still doing that research. And he really downplays her role. He can't really talk about it at first because the Nazis would then go after her. Potentially, he was trying to be good in that way as to not, sick the Nazis on her. But even after it's safe again, after the Nazis are defeated, he still downplays her role, her involvement. And their third, the third person in their little research trio is just livid at him. He's like so angry at him for sort of pushing her away. And then Otto gets the Nobel for the discovery of nuclear fission. And Lise never made it. So there's like a saying, I think that I include in the book, that Lise was most famous for winning Otto Hahn a Nobel Prize, right?
And the other thing that was really interesting, though, about Lise is that there were people who recognized her role in discovering fission, and they did try and recruit her for the Manhattan Project, and she refused.
Yes, so the sort of snowballed. Yes, at the very beginning, like people, once the knowledge of the bomb building, the potential of what this discovery was, right, they recognized that her role in it, and made these sort of wild newspaper stories about this Jewish woman like flees the borders with a bomb in her pocket, like it's like just making up these ridiculous stories, right? Because they know it'll sell papers. But she, having been at the a volunteer nurse in World War One at the front, saw what war did. She saw, the breakdown of humanity, and never again. She said, "I'm not, not going to be party to creating this kind of suffering." She knew the potential there, and so when she was approached to work on building a bomb, she said, "Absolutely not. No way am I going to do this." And I feel like that we should celebrate her more for saying no. Sometimes going ahead and doing it maybe isn't the best idea, right? So saying no is the braver stance, to say that this shouldn't happen. Just because it could happen doesn't mean it should happen.
Yeah. And of course, the American government was concerned that the Nazis were close to having the bomb, because that original research, of course, had been done in Germany. Otto was still there. He was working with the Nazis at that point, essentially. But why were they not successful? It turns out they weren't anywhere near creating a bomb. Why were they not successful? I mean, other than the fact that they'd sent their best scientists away because they were Jewish.
I think that's a big part of it. I'd like to hope that Otto, kind of slowed down any research, or, was trying to dig his heels in.
Maybe dragged his feet a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was known as not a supporter of the Nazis. He didn't choose to leave, and he chose to stay and continue his work to continue to support the Nazi regime. But before all the Jewish colleagues had to flee, he was a known anti-Nazi. So I'd like to think that he didn't push as hard as he could have. But I really think it's because they just wrecked their whole science all their science teams. Like they brought in people for like, oh, this guy is like into Nazi eugenics. Let's give him this top job, even though he has no business being in this job.
Wait a minute, that sounds really familiar.
I know, right? Doesn't it?
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, we like what this person says, but they have no business, they have no experience and no real reason to be here. But because they're going to disseminate the propaganda that we want, they deserve this high level position. So I think that they were just a mess as far as science went, and that all of their top brains had been disseminated out. They were all at the Manhattan Project. They were all anywhere else but there.
Wow. So did any of these women come from like scientific families that really supported their education, or did they just like do it all on their own?
I didn't come across like legacies of science parents, but that is a common thing. A lot of the early women in science would have either had a spouse or a brother or a father that they would have sort of helped them shoehorn into the profession or into an education in that area. Yes, I didn't see that here. I know Hedwig was from a big, wealthy Jewish family, and they were very supportive of her education. She went to a women's or a girl's school that then she went further than most other girls her age did in her education, and she studied for the entrance exams to university. And so that was something that very few girls at the time did, but her parents definitely supported that. Lise needed financial support from her parents in the first few years because she was volunteering, right? She also did some like editing of scientific papers and wrote some papers for a little bit of pocket money. She mostly spent on cigarettes. She's great. So she needed her parents' permission to leave Austria to go to Germany and study under these eminent physicists that she couldn't really go as far as she wanted to in Austria in her career. So she wanted to learn. And so she gets to Germany and they're like, "Why? What do you need to be at this university for? You already have your PhD in physics. What are you doing?" And she's like, "Well, I want to learn from the best. I want to do this specific, you know, type of physics or whatnot." So she, you know, her parents are sending her money still for the first few years there because, she needs to pay room and board. She's not living with her family. Hedwig lived with her family while she went to university. It was just a few blocks away. So
at least as far as you can tell, the families weren't obstacles. They may not have been promoting it necessarily, promoting their, you know, daughter's education, but they weren't standing in the way.
Yes, I didn't find any evidence of that here. My first book, there was definitely, I mean, we're talking like, you know, significantly earlier in time, you know, mid-1800s is my first book. So we have a lot of families that are like, "No way you're doing this. We're going to disown you rather than pay for your education." And, you know, yes, I definitely didn't see any evidence of that here, whether it wasn't documented or I just didn't, you know. But it felt like their families were supportive, and that's why they got as far as they did.
Now, there were men in the sciences at the universities, at the institutes, there were men who tried to keep women out, but there were also men who maybe didn't necessarily welcome them with open arms, but looked at them as scientists rather than looking at their gender first, and ended up being strong mentors, strong supporters. Who were some of those men?
So, I mean, Otto Hahn is certainly one of those. He and Lise were collaborators from almost her arrival in Germany. He was not, you know, had no qualms about her gender whatsoever. He saw her amazing mind. And knew that they could create something, and he was really, really intrigued. I think a lot of the men that were more welcoming had been to maybe institutes or colleges or had some sort of experiences outside of Germany working with him. And I think it was either Otto or James Frank, who worked in Canada with some amazing women physicists there. So yes, James Frank is the other really, really welcoming person here. He's just such a great guy. I really loved researching him. He seems like such an amazing person.
And he really helped all of them get out too, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because he had already emigrated himself.
Yes. He came to Baltimore and then Chicago, and he was getting paid twice as much. But no, he deserved it. He was a Nobel laureate. He was incredible also. But yes, James and Lise and Herta worked with Einstein and others at the KWI and Otto as well. And James and Otto didn't care. You know, it was just, they happened to be women, and that was okay. And I think a lot of times they might have also felt like they had to be extra protective of them also, extra advocating for them. So when James moved his position to a different university and brought Herta with him, there was a really anti-woman director at that university. And he basically, James had to say, I'm responsible for Herta. As long as I'm here, she will have a job. You're not going to try to get rid of her, et cetera, et cetera. And then, so as soon, because James was Jewish, as soon as he left, Herta got fired because she didn't have her protector anymore. And this was a story that was repeated at many, many other institutes that I found, women's whose employment was contingent upon a male mentor, a male supervisor. And as soon as that person was Jewish and they had to disappear, the women were out of luck. They were fired immediately because they weren't wanted there in the first place. I know Lise talks about when she first comes to the institute, to the college in Berlin, how like most of the other research assistants don't even acknowledge her. They don't even say good morning. They'll say good morning to James or Otto as they're walking by, but they don't even acknowledge her existence there. She wasn't allowed into the regular area of the institute. She had to stay in the basement. She couldn't enter the institute through the same door as the male assistants. She had to enter through her own door. And there was no bathroom in the basement. So she had to go down the street to the cafe to go to the bathroom.
And this is less than 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking like late 1920s. Yeah.
And it wasn't any better in the U.S., really.
No. I mean, it was a little bit further along, but I think there was just as frustrated women and coming up to just as, you know, many roadblocks. In America, we had women's colleges. And that's basically if you wanted to become a scientist, if you wanted to go to college, you went to one of the women's colleges if you were a woman, and that's where you were employed. Like most of the women who graduated with science degrees, if they wanted to keep doing science, were then employed by the women's colleges.
One of the things that was so heartbreaking in this book, Sisters in Science, was how hard it was for these women who were literally fleeing for their lives to get out because the other countries weren't letting them in, basically, weren't providing jobs, weren't giving them visas, weren't letting them in. And I've known, you know, we like to think that we were, that the U.S. was, you know, the heroes of World War II, and in some ways we were, but the fact that, you know, we turned away so many Jewish refugees, just like we're turning away refugees now, who, for no real reason other than bigotry.
I was shocked. In the early days of the 30s, you know, 33 is when the Nazis, when Hitler came to power. So if you knew exactly then what was going to happen and you fled immediately, you probably would have found, you know, solace somewhere pretty easily. So in the first couple of years, people got out quick. But as the international community started to realize what was really going on, what plans Hitler had and how violent he was going to be with his own people, and how he then started annexing surrounding countries, right? That's when we have hundreds of thousands of people trying to get out suddenly, and you know, no space elsewhere to accommodate that volume of people. And we also have people who maybe initially fled to surrounding areas in Europe, and then suddenly they get trapped again when their country is annexed. So they're in trouble again. They didn't flee far enough. So we have these women who have been held back in their careers, held back in their education, not permitted to be a professor for very long by this point, right? They would go up to the university administration and say, hey, I'd like to apply to do this. It's basically a whole other PhD to allow them to be a professor. Because it was like it's a very official thing in Germany. It's like you have to pass this huge test to prove that not only that you have the knowledge, but that you are capable of disseminating it as a professor, which makes sense to me. It's a good thing, but it's also sort of kept the women out for sure.
And there was a word, habilitation.
Habilitation, yeah, that's what it's called. It was like you write a huge paper and then you present it to the administration, right? So that then you would be passing your habilitation, you would be certified to be a professor. So they applied several times before they were, you know, allowed, because they're like, oh no, you can't do that because you're a woman. So when suddenly it's you're facing the Nazis coming to, you know, deport you, to take you to a camp, to fire you because of you're a woman, because you're Jewish, and you need to escape, right? Well, international universities and countries, well, yes, they are more interested in having educated people come in. They're useful. So I talk a little bit about how this is kind of a messed up way of looking at it too, because that we have these special visas for professional people, these special visas for certain groups of well-educated class of people to immigrate more quickly, more easily. And I think that's not right either. But there were academics could use these to their advantage. But when the women went looking for jobs, first of all, they're a woman. That's ding number one for at any university in America. I mean, American universities, most of them weren't even hiring women at the time. They, you know,
and even some of the women's colleges said they wanted a man to teach science.
Yeah. So, and they're like, oh, you know, we're coming off the Depression. We don't have, we don't have any money to offer you anything. And most of the time there was aid organizations that were providing the funding. They're like, we just need you to say, I have a post for this person. They can teach one class, a semester or something, and you have a room for them. That's all we need. We'll give them, you know, $3,000 for the year for their, you know, to live on, for living expenses. So you don't need to even pay them. But because the women hadn't been teaching for very long, they hadn't maybe had a career for very long, they'd been an assistant for a very long time and not had their been in charge of their own lab, you know, that's why they didn't look good on paper to these international universities. Well, yeah, that's how misogyny kills. Like, yeah. Literally, because they were held back, that's the only reason that they didn't look good. And because the fact that they were women in the first place.
Yeah,
but like, it's hard enough to find jobs for, you know, great men right now. Why are you bothering to steal this job from a man? That was kind of the prevailing idea.
One of the organizations that I saw repeatedly in the book that provided funding was the Rockefeller Foundation, which was kind of surprising to me that they were doing that.
Yeah, it was really interesting to find the different, I mean, so many of these organizations sprang up for, you know, based on the sudden need that there was. And that was also another issue. It's like there was might have been plenty of funding money, you know, towards the middle of the 1930s. But as you get to later in the 1930s, 1940s, there, you know, the money's gone. There's no money left.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's all kinds of crazy acronym organizations just for these refugees, just to try to get them out, the lengths that people were going to. And I think that those were some of my favorite characters in this story, is the women that were working at these aid organizations and who had to be the kind of go-between. They were hearing these incredible, you know, terrifying sob stories of these women who were like, you know, I'm about to get deported. They're about to kill me. You have to save me. And I can't imagine what that must have been like for those people working at the aid organizations, because they couldn't save them all, right? There wasn't enough money and visas to save them all. Like, they did all they could. And I'm sure that they were like super like stressed and like, you know, that they were haunted by the women that didn't make it, the people that they weren't able to help.
Now, some of these women were sort of allowed to leave, but at least one of them had to kind of sneak out of the country.
So we have Herta and Hildegard leave fairly freely because they're not Jewish, but Herta is sort of a known Jewish sympathizer. Her supervisor, James Frank, who was a very high profile leaving the country. He decided to quit rather than stay to be fired, but out of principle, like, this was a big to do. And they didn't like that. The Nazis didn't like when, you know, people made a public display of this, because it looked really bad for them. So being his assistant then would have put her in a more of a high profile position, possibly. She was able to leave freely, but once she gotten to, she made a stopover in Norway before she came to the US. And then she had all these like papers coming for her and like people asking her to speak out against the Nazis publicly. And there were newspaper stories written about her. And because of this, she was branded an enemy of the state in Germany. Her sister was an academic who stayed behind and joined the resistance. She was murdered by the Nazis. So Lise has to sneak out because she's waited so long. There's patrols, you know, at the train stations. She's just terrified that she's going to get stopped. She can only pack like a really light, tiny suitcase so it doesn't look suspicious, right? She can't pack all her stuff. She's like freezing in Sweden because she's packed this like, oh, it's a little vacation bag of my summer clothes. I'm just going to visit my family in Austria. And, you know, she's got to leave all her stuff behind, because she's a high profile scientist in the country. She's a known, you know, person. She's head of one of the areas of the KWI. So,
but she is Jewish, right?
And she is considered Jewish. Yes, she converted to Christianity as an adult, but because her grandparents are Jewish, she's considered Jewish. So that was a really sort of complicated thing to write about, because the Nazis didn't care what you practiced, what you thought of yourself as. They cared about what was in your DNA. They cared about whether, you know, this was in your ancestry, whether you were Jewish or not. It had nothing to do with what church you went to. Wow. So she felt very uneasy about being welcomed and celebrated in Jewish communities in America and elsewhere, because she didn't really identify with that. But the Nazis certainly identified her as Jewish, and she had to kind of reconcile that.
Wow. You know, when we're talking about the men who were sort of supportive of women scientists, Einstein was fairly open-minded, wasn't he?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. He, like I mentioned, he was a supportive of the mathematician, the woman who was trying to become a professor at this one university, who didn't want to have her. And he was like, no, guys, she's a genius. You're being stupid. What are you doing? And he was about to come over there and like personally advocate for her. But you know, at the end, he didn't have to. No, he was a great supporter of these women. He was very progressive. And so, yeah, it was very refreshing to have these men to, you know, kind of counter the other men who were just being really vile to them, you know? Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Olivia Campbell, author of Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. Were there some things that you found during your research that really surprised you?
That's a great question. I think I was surprised by how sort of tight-knit these scientific communities were. I think it's kind of hard to fathom as an American, like how tiny European countries are, and just how interconnected the scientific community was, how long scientific studies were taking. Like, that's really surprising to me that there's a lot of stops and starts, and the fact that these incredible scientists could also be stumped by things. Like, they talk about this one lecture. There was like a weekly lecture in Berlin that became like a huge international deal. Like, people would come from all over to this physics lecture, and someone would present a paper. And Lise talks about she and James were just like, we have no idea what that speech was just about. We just didn't get it. And I loved that admission, and the fact that they were, there were concepts that they didn't understand either. And I thought that was really interesting and really refreshing. It wasn't just me, that this is over my head, but even someone so advanced in physics could, there were still aspects of what was being discovered that that were really, really out there.
Now, you mentioned the area of physics that all these women were involved in with which spectrography?
So the
What is
three
that
H-ladies
exactly?
were into spectroscopy. They so you have it was so you have a flame on one side and like a little examination tube, kind of like a telescope on the other side, and you would put whatever you were studying on one side, and you would introduce a flame to it. That's flame spectroscopy, and to sort of see then that what would be reflected in your viewing area was a spectrum of light. So then you could interpret what that element was made of. So at the atomic level, what things are made of basically is what they were studying. And then Lise is into nuclear physics,
Obviously. So
so.
the how do you say it again?
Spectroscopy.
Spectroscopy. Okay. So that had a lot of applications in lighting then, right?
Yes, we have Hedwig has a patent in lighting technology, and that's why she was able to stay employed for slightly longer after getting fired because of being Jewish. She worked in private industry with lighting companies in Germany, and she could make lighting better, make bulbs that worked better.
Wow. And you said some of their findings and so forth were referenced for decades.
Yeah, I mean they were making incredible, notable findings, and the fact that we don't know any of their names is just
Wow.
shocking to me. And like I said, a lot of their findings that would be then built upon. So like you find out one thing, and then, oh well, if that's true, then this must be. So it's a sort of sparking that chain of realization, that chain of thought, in other scientists who are, much more likely to be household names. So, but the base research was by these women in a lot of cases.
Olivia, before we run out of time, I'd like you to read from the Sisters in Science.
Sure, yeah. So I flagged the two chapters that talk do sort of a backstory about the state of women in science. I don't, you can stop me if I go too long,
Okay.
but the chapters are pretty short and clippy, so I should have time for both those chapters. And if one is fine, then just stop me then. So this is Chapter 3, Women Make Inroads in Science. Throughout the late 1800s, German women had been forced to watch from the sidelines as foreign women were allowed entry into their universities first. In 1893, Americans Margaret Elizabeth Maltby and Mary Frances Winston, along with Britt Grace Emily Chisholm, enrolled at the University of Göttingen. All three were frustrated that they couldn't earn terminal degrees in their native countries. Margaret studied physics while Mary and Grace tackled mathematics. Margaret became the first woman to earn a physics PhD in Germany when she graduated in 1895. Mary was the first American woman to earn a PhD in math at any European university. Foreign women were then expected to return to their home countries. They would not be permitted to stay and upset Germany's traditional gender roles. German women who wanted to attend university mostly went to Switzerland. In the US, physics, originally called natural philosophy, was once considered a women's subject, readily taught at finishing schools and women's seminaries. As with most other sciences, physics slowly transformed into a boys' club as the profession progressed and began requiring advanced degrees. Women fought valiantly for the right to attend college in the US, but often were forced to be satisfied with separate women-only institutions. The first American graduate schools had been modeled on those in Germany, which did not allow women students. If women were to be able to earn an education, it would have to be separate, at least for a while. It was the only way women could ensure they wouldn't face sexism and harassment just for attending college classes. In the case of sciences, they remained largely confined to disciplines considered appropriately feminine, such as botany, anthropology, zoology, or nursing. Isabella Stone became the first woman to receive a PhD in physics in America in 1897. But allowing women to matriculate at higher education institutions didn't mean they'd be welcome in the professions. When these educated women tried to get jobs or join science societies, men again saw it as women invading their turf. Under the auspices of professionalization of sciences, men barred women from further encroachment by ensuring that for a long time, women could not join professional societies and could only hold positions as men's assistants. When scientific organizations ostensibly acquiesced to accepting women members, they would often use tactics like encouraging smoking after meals at events to subtly tell women they were not welcome. Until the 1920s, it was considered inappropriate for women to smoke alongside men or be around smoking men. That was the fun anecdote. So an invitation to an event that mentioned a smoker would follow a meal was a hint that women should stay away. The introduction of the German smokers was long a bar to women being present at the banquets of the physical society, but finally a number of the younger women joined, remarked Sarah Whiting, an early woman physicist in America. When looking back on her first years of attendance at these meetings in 1907, I was not quite sure we were welcome, for men had not then as now gotten over the idea that blue smoke and the presence of ladies at banquets were incompatible. In 1906, the first edition of American Men in Science described the lives of 4,131 scientists. Notice it's called American Men of Science. And even though it had women in it for very many years, that was the title. Happily by 19, sorry, I skipped it. Let's see. So of the 4,131 scientists, of whom 149 were women, the 1910 edition listed 204 women, so not much of an improvement there. But by 1921, the number of women scientists worthy of note had more than doubled. 450 of their biographies were included. Most of them worked in academia. The number of women scientists who'd achieved the rank of assistant professor more than tripled. Yet most of the institutions employing them were women's colleges. Women physicists in particular were relegated to the halls of separate lady-only higher education establishments. Of the 24 women physicists listed in the 1921 edition of American Men of Science, 19 worked at women's colleges. Many men still had trouble seeing women as effective physicists. The women's experience thus reflects a basic inconsistency in these years. American society became far more willing to educate women in science than to employ them, and were almost adamantly opposed to advancing or promoting any but the most extraordinary, noted Margaret Rossiter, a renowned historian of women in science. In Germany, things started to change when women were finally granted the right to attend university across the country in 1908. Within 6 years, about 4,000 women were enrolled. Unfortunately, then that 1908 declaration did not grant women permission to take the exams required to work in certain fields. Progress always seemed to have limits. The First World War also provided an important catalyst for women to obtain jobs in areas they would not normally be considered for. While men were away fighting, women entered scientific industries and other professions to help pick up the slack. Many women jumped at the chance to finally prove their scientific and technological aptitude. Between 1913 and 1918, the number of women employed in the engineering field went up 544% in Germany. At the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute's lab for physical chemistry in Berlin, for example, it wasn't just that women were needed to fill men's posts. The war had created new posts. As the need for gas masks grew, so did the institution. In 1914, the KWIPC staff had less than 30 people, 5 scientists, 10 assistants, and 13 volunteers and students. By 1917, it had massively ballooned to 1,500.
Whoa.
150 were scientists, and the rest were support staff, most of whom were women, employed as gas mask testing technicians. Overall, between 1907 and 1925, the number of employed women in Germany increased by 35%, while the female population only increased 15%. To women's chagrin, this wartime work was largely considered a temporary necessity and failed to push the needle very far on the wider acceptance of women scientists. Their interest in pursuing science, engineering, or other analytical subjects was still considered unnatural. But women like Hedwig were helping to chip away at these disparities and stereotypes, showing the world that women could make incredible physicists.
Thank you. That was Olivia Campbell reading from Sisters in Science. And unfortunately, I don't think we'll have time to go on to the other chapter. What was the other chapter about, the next one you were going to read?
Let's see here. The next one was the interwar era, Women in the Interwar Era, chapter 11.
Wow.
So seeing how far we've gotten in the 1920s. So buy the book to find out what
happened. Yeah, and how these women finally were able to escape and what happened to them in their lives afterwards. How long did you work on this book, Olivia?
Let's see. 3 years-ish, something like that. Yeah, it took longer than I thought. I had to push my deadlines, my original deadline. Yes, I was optimistic because, I've written a book before. It'll be easier this time right now. Well, I added one woman to the mix. I only wrote about 3 women before, and this is 4 women. And it's in German, and it's about physics. You know, I know a lot more about medical stuff than I do about physics. So this was a huge learning curve. You know, I hired a translator.
I was going to say, did you have to, was a lot of the research in German? And yeah.
Yes.
Do you like pretty much all the research and then start writing, or do you research a little, write a little, research a little, write a little?
It was hard because, it's such a huge topic, like World War II, Holocaust. Like, if you get to, I started to panic. Like, I had to really refocus myself. This is just about these 4 women, and whatever you need to include to sort of contextualize their story only. You don't need to tell other people have told the bigger stories here. You're just telling this story. So I kept coming back to that. I definitely do a lot of research first, and then I go in and, you know, I feel like my journalism background helps me find those good quotes to tell you about people. And then I have the chapters and I go, okay, what questions are still left? What am I still looking for? So I'll go back and do more research and try to answer those questions that I still have. So that part of the research is much easier because I know exactly what I'm looking for. At the beginning, I have to see, okay, this is everything I have. How does this make a story? And then I can go back and say, okay, but what still haven't I unfolded yet? What still needs to be tugged at a little bit?
Wow. Well, thank you. This is really important to know the history of things like this, of women like this, so that we can make sure we never go back to that.
I hope I've done their stories justice.
Yeah.
That's the whole goal for me here, is that they would enjoy and be proud to read this and to know that someone is still reading
still,
their stories.
It's still paying attention. Absolutely. I'm going to end with a quote from Lise Meitner. Life need not be easy, provided only that it is not empty. So thank you for being with us today, Olivia. Sisters in Science, How 4 Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. And see you all.